This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, Jenny Murray welcoming you to the Woman's Hour podcast for the 17th of September 2020. Good morning. The campaign group Back to 60 has lost its appeal for women born in the 1950s to have the pensions they expected to receive restored. What options are available to them now? Women in journalism have produced a report showing a lack of diversity in the media. What does a majority of the male, pale and posh say about what news is covered and the careers of female journalists? And the sale of alcohol to women. Why has advertising become pink and glittery with the slogan female empowerment? Dame Jacqueline Wilson is one of our most popular writers for children and young people, with 111 books to her name. She's a former children's laureate, and she's often tackled themes such as divorce and adoption, which were considered controversial at the time. Her latest publication, Love, Frankie, is about Frankie, who lives with her two sisters, her mother, and a dog called Bear. Her mother has been diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and the day before this extract, she had fallen over outside the school.
They were all chiming in, but it was Sally Mack singing when I burst through the door. 10 wine bottles hanging on the wall, 10 wine bottles hanging on the wall, and if Frankie Bennett's mother should accidentally fall, then she's drunk all the bottles hanging on the wall. They were all giggling away, but stopped when they saw me. I went straight up to Sally and slapped her hard across the face. There was a big gasp. Sally rocked on her heels in shock, one side of her face white and the other bright red. "For Christ's sake, Frankie," she said. "Slap her back, Sally," Marnie egged her on. "Hey, there's going to be a cat fight," said one of the boys. "Fight, fight, fight," they started chanting. "Don't you dare slap me around," said Sally. "It's not my fault your mum's drunk." "She is not a drunk. She couldn't help falling. She's ill," I hissed. "Oh, yeah, my dad always says he's ill when he's had a few," said Marnie. "My mother didn't have a drop to drink. Now shut your stupid faces or you'll all get slapped," I said wildly. "Frankie's gone berserk. Look at her eyes. Get out of her way or she'll go for you. Maybe she's been drinking too." They all tittered nervously, acting like they were really scared of me. But Sally wasn't, though her cheek was still a bright burning red. She came right up to me so we were nose to nose. "Don't you dare slap me again, freak," she said. After that, we were deadly enemies.
But it's not quite so simple. Frankie falls in love for the first time, and it's Sally who becomes the object of her passion. Jacqueline, this is the first time you've written about a same-sex relationship. Why has it taken you so long?
I thought it was about time. I have written about gay characters, but they've been on the kind of periphery of the story. This time I wanted my main narrator to suddenly, much to her surprise, fall in love with this other girl in her class. I've written about girls falling in love with boys several times for my teenage stories. This time I thought, right, let's have a same-sex, not relationship, romance.
How concerned were you that the publishing industry might be resistant to such a story?
I didn't really think about it, actually. I think times have changed so much. I mean, when I was young, the very idea of writing about a schoolgirl romance was certainly not something you would find in, I don't know, Enid Blyton and the Twins at St. Clair, something like that. Now I think we're much more open, much more understanding about gay relationships. And certainly when I suggested this, there was no problem whatsoever. People said, yes, that sounds good. Yes, OK, go ahead, Jackie.
You revealed earlier this year that you've lived with your partner, Trish, for 18 years, I think it is. Why did you feel now was the time to be open about your own life?
Well, I've always been open in all my friends, family, mere acquaintances, work colleagues. Everybody knew Trish and we've always been totally accepted as a couple. But I did realise that when Love, Frankie came out, people might think, you know, who are you to write about a gay relationship? You don't know about it, or just want to know about my private life. That is a way of life nowadays. And so I thought I would give an interview to somebody on The Guardian and just be completely open about it so that there wouldn't be too much fuss. Because nowadays, I think it's not some great standing on a pedestal coming out thing, and it's not kind of my style anyway. I'm too old for that sort of thing. But I wanted it to show that it's lovely to have a gay relationship. It's also lovely to have a straight relationship. Let's hope we're in the kind of world where most of us feel that, you know, you take your pick nowadays.
Let me just remind you, Jacqueline, that 74 is not old, all right?
Thank you very much, Jenny. That's kind of you.
What sort of response did you actually get when it was made public?
Mostly, people were completely warm, feeling very, very proud in a way, so some of my gay friends said. And you see, the secret of happiness in life is not to be on Twitter too much. I don't think as far as I'm aware, wasn't a Twitter storm about me or anything like that. But I think nowadays people, particularly if you're older like me, it's no big deal whatsoever. So it's just people say, oh, yeah, OK, and that's it. And I think that's the way it should be.
Now, Frankie is very open with her family about her feelings for Sally. How easy was it for you to be open with your family when you were younger?
Well, I was in a straight marriage with a guy for many years, so there was no issue involved. I'm one of these sorts of people. I just fall in love with somebody and it doesn't really matter to me whether they're male or female. So then after my marriage broke up, I was single for a while, and then I met Trish, and, you know, it just seemed lovely, just the person I wanted to live the rest of my life with. My daughter was immensely supportive and is very fond of Trish. My mum was difficult, but then my mum's always been difficult. She couldn't bear my husband. She couldn't bear any of my friends. And so even though she herself had gay friendships, I mean, not she had gay friendships. My mother, if she was still alive, would be very cross if I suggested that. But she was quite irritating at times, but I got used to that.
How important was it to show, as you do in the novel, what a confusing time first teenage love can be? Because Frankie has a lot of interest from boys, even her best friend next door, Sam.
Yes.
And she's often in a bit of a muddle about it all.
Well, I think it is a muddling time. And it sort of creeps up on you unawares, and then you are just So it's so exciting. It's as if nobody else could ever have had these feelings. You go around with your head filled with this person. You start sort of chanting their name. And yet you're frightened that you feel like this. You're worried that they don't feel the same way about you. I want to reassure anybody reading the book, gay or straight, it's okay. This is what it feels like. If it doesn't work out, that will be okay. If it does work out, well, good for you. It's just a sort of rite of passage that people go through. And certainly, people my age, if you ask them, can you remember the first time you fell in love? There's a twinkle in the eye as people look back, because it's such an intense feeling.
Now, Frankie's mother, as I've said, is very ill with multiple sclerosis. Why did you want to highlight that particular condition?
I think it's a very difficult illness. And I have a dear friend who has MS and works on valiantly. Few people would actually know the different things she goes through. It's a difficult illness because some people are very lucky. They have one little bout of it and then they go into remission and nothing else ever happens. Other people, they have to deal with it getting worse and worse. I'm a member of a very good charity, Stop MS, where there's all sorts of research taking place, where we're nearly at the stage where they will be able to find the right combination of drugs or treatment where people can stay in remission. We just have to hope for the best. But it's an illness that hasn't been particularly highlighted at all. And it's one of those difficult ones where you can't really look into the future and know for sure what's going to happen. And so I didn't want for any young person reading the book, and if they had a parent or a close friend who had MS, I didn't want to be too depressing about it. I wanted to show that there's hope and you can still lead a really full life for a very long time, if not forever. But it was on my mind. And so I wanted Frankie to be at this state where it's very difficult for any child. And she's a loving girl. They're a very close family. She's very worried about her mother. Her parents are split up. She's got all these things going on in her mind. And then suddenly this great romantic thing happens to her. And in a way, it's a way of living in her world and experiencing a very different sort of life from the ordinary, usual, humdrum family one.
Just one other point about her. She really wants to be a writer and meets up with a friend and Mr. White in the library to form a writing group. And I wondered, how much is that a parallel with your own childhood?
I certainly wanted to be a writer. Sadly, there were no Mr. Whites in my life and nobody sort of really encouraged me to be a writer. In fact, I was told quite firmly at school that it would be very unlikely that I would ever get published. And the careers in those long ago days seemed to be nursing or teaching. Or as an alternative, you got married. It was very limiting. I really just thought privately, no, I want to be a writer so much. I was lucky I managed to get a job as a very junior journalist up in Scotland with DC Thompson's when I was 17. And so it taught me a great deal. I've sometimes wished I'd been able to go on to university, but now I think I've tried my very hardest to educate myself, and it's been a great career. It really has.
Jacqueline Wilson, I think you went in absolutely the right direction. Thank you very much indeed for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much, Jenny.
Now, Women in Journalism has published a report this week showing the results of a study over a week in the British media, newspapers, television and radio, to try and assess how much diversity there was among writers, presenters and the kind of stories that were covered. Not much, it would appear. No UK front page story was written by a black reporter. Out of 174 front page bylines, only two were written by women from a black and ethnic minority. On the radio, four black women were reporters out of 723 contributions. Well, what does this mean for what news is covered and what future do women have as journalists? Well, I'm joined by Amal Wasami, who's a graduate in the MA in Financial Journalism at City University of London, Yasmin Alibi Brown, who's a regular columnist for The Eye and The Evening Standard, and Jane Martinson, Professor of Financial Journalism at City and a columnist at The Guardian. Jane, why did you think it was important to do this kind of research over a week?
Well, it was really because we'd done similar research for women, Jenny, 8 years ago when I was chair. We did the first piece of research, this similar snapshot. It takes a week and it takes all the sort of flagship, so front pages of newspapers, you know, the sort of primetime news reports, sort of really seeing, if you just look at one particular week, what happens. And it was shocking, the lack of any BAME, particularly black voices, actually. Not just the bylines reporters, but 111 people were quoted as experts and only one black woman was there. And that was when Jen Reid, when she was actually made into a statue in Bristol. So the very heart of the story. And I suppose the reason which I wanted to do this research is it really is a media, you know, trying to reflect society. It seems increasingly that it's not changing. It is still dominated, overwhelmingly dominated by white posh men, you know, male, pale and posh. And that has to change because our society is changing. And if the media is going to have a future, it needs to change too.
Amal, what response did you have to what was revealed in this research?
I had quite, some people were very shocked in regards to the findings. But others, like women of ethnic minorities, some were saying it's not shocking because that's kind of the reality. It's people in the industry, they know that they're not really being represented enough. Do you know what I mean? So it was kind of, you know, I guess with if you're someone like me who was black, a young journalist getting into the industry, you can be, you know, you might not be surprised because this is what you see every day in the newspapers and the TV and the radio.
Now, Yasmin, I think you were the first person of colour to have a column in a national newspaper. What impact did you have at the time?
Well, yeah, I feel like the kind of grandmother of all of this. But I know for a fact, because I was told, that in a few years, the readership expanded. Because the way I was writing and what I was saying and how I was reading the world was bringing in this perspective of being a migrant, a Muslim, a female, a woman of color. And I know that, you know, internationally, the audience figures changed and expanded. And being there for a long time, 18 years, I became a voice of a newspaper in a way that had never happened before. And it really does break my heart to see how little really is changing, that people, you know, just for monetary reasons, for profit reasons, the media doesn't get the potential out there if they only diversified properly.
Jane, as a woman from a working class background, albeit a white woman from a working class background, how have you fared among what you've called the male, pale and posh gang?
I think I managed to hide my roots for quite a long time, Jenny, because having been brought up on the Isle of Dogs, and I went to a comprehensive and lived in a council house. I then went to Cambridge. So when I found myself working at the Financial Times and then the Guardian, it was fine to fit in, you know, because I'd gone to the college. But that, I mean, it was awful because that really is sort of something that I think the industry is getting worse. because it's becoming, it is really competitive, the ways to get into the industry, they are still many. But, you know, one of the ways in is doing an MA, which obviously someone teaching an MA at the moment, it's brilliant to go to City, but it does cost money. And we do have scholarships. You know, Amal has been brilliant. She's just graduated this year. There are lots of people like that, but there just aren't enough. So we need to really think about if we want to actually look at the stories that matter, how people are living their lives, what actually happens. It's not just about one tiny group of people in society, and it has to. That's why I think it's important when we talk about diversity,
but not to diminish the importance of race. But Jane, on this male pale and posh question, what difference has the fact that we now have 5 female national newspaper editors made at The Sun, The Guardian, The FT, The Sunday Times and The Mirror?
I think it does make a huge difference, actually. For a start, it's that you can't be what you can't see. So when you do have more women in positions of power and more women on the television, I mean, it's really interesting that the TV in this research has changed in the 8 years since the last piece of research that we did. I mean, it's still, there's still sort of huge issues like Newsnight having no, you know, woman, man of colour during the 1 week. But it has changed. And I think, look, it's unbelievably frustratingly slow. I mean, you know, the amount of change. When people see, say, whether it's, you know, Catherine Graviner at The Guardian or Ruda Kalaf at the FT, I mean, all these sort of great women leading, of course it makes a difference. But actually, for the industry as a whole, it's glacial, the pace of change.
Yasmin, why do you think it's still a problem after you've been present for all these years, but so few women seem to have followed you?
Maybe I've just been a too dangerous voice, I don't know. But I think one of the things that it must be, as Jane says, as situations get more competitive, and the media is a very difficult area to get into now. In some ways, it was easier when I got in because there wasn't this amount of pressure and competition. And the more, when it becomes less competitive, I'm sorry to say this, but white men of a certain class and a certain background become more keen on promoting their own, preserving the enclave, than actually opening up. And what happens then is we are in the news, you know, diverse people, Black and Asian people are in the news, but as objects, as people to talk about, not to be part driving the conversations. So we're hauled up to talk about Land of Hope and Glory, you know, as kind of puppets to battle out these fake battles, but we are not leading the conversations. And I think the more competition there is, the harder it's going to get. And it's just not acceptable, actually.
How optimistic, Amal, are you about your own chances in journalism, having taken part in this research?
I am quite optimistic because being part of this research, it just shows how important it is to, you know, to get our voices out there and to remind the industry that the diversity is still not happening. We're not, you know, being represented enough. So I am hopeful, even for the younger generation, is just to show an example that we're still doing the work and we still have to be positive and change will happen.
But what actually really needs to be done, Amal, to give opportunities to a wider range of people of talent?
In regards to that, it really depends on the leaders of the industry, the editors, to give way to younger, women of colour, different ethnicities, different social class, even people with disability and genders. I mean, if we have the skills and the ability and the capability, we should be encouraged to get better and to develop our skills further. I mean, sometimes you can get a job at the entry level, but going from, you know, a producer to maybe a reporter or be a, you know, a presenter at TV, that's where the challenge is. And that's where we need to see the difference to take, you know, to do more steps to get us there.
Yasmin, what do you reckon needs to actually be done?
Do you know, I know I'm very old-fashioned, But I really think positive discrimination is the only way. That's what changed America. This is simply not true of American media. And what changed everything in America, I know there are terrible problems in America on race. I'm not, you know, romanticizing that country. But when it comes to employment and progress and retention and power, they're doing much better because they had positive discrimination. There's no other way.
Jane, positive discrimination?
Yeah, and I actually think getting the data, I mean, I think once you start counting, once you start really looking, it's so easy for people to say, you know, well, look at that one senior woman over there, the industry's changed enormously. And then you look at the number and 10 years on, it's still one in four women are writing front page stories, still 30% are actually speaking as experts on TV and radio. So we need to track the numbers and then hold these companies to account and say, you keep speaking these warm, warm words about diversity and inclusion. What have you done about it?
Jane Martinson, Amal Wasami and Yasmin Alibi Brown, thank you all very much indeed for being with us this morning. And we would, of course, like to hear from you on this subject. What have you observed as you read your newspapers, listen to your radio, watch your television? And what do you think about it? You can send us an email or, of course, you can send us a tweet. Now, still to come in today's programme, the way alcohol is sold to women. Why have the colour pink, a lot of glitter and the slogan female empowerment become so common? And does it work? And the serial, the fourth episode of Lifelines. As you may have read this morning, the campaign group Back to 60 has failed in the High Court to achieve its aim of enabling women born in the 1950s who missed out on their pensions at the age of 60 to have the money they expected to get restored. The judges said they were sympathetic to the women's case, but said there was no unlawful discrimination under EU and human rights law, and the changes were a long overdue move towards gender equality. So where does that leave the 3.8 million women affected by the raising of the state pension age? Joanne Welsh is the director of Back to 60. Joanne, what was the reaction of Julie Delve and Carol Glynn, who really led the appeal to the ruling?
Well, good morning, Danny. They were astounded, like everybody else, because we won leave to appeal on all grounds. So we expected a win, and we still expect to win. We will never retreat. And along those lines, you know, as the client, that's myself, and the claimants, Julie Delve and Karen Glynn, they've been actively considering the next steps. And I can confirm this morning that Karen and Julie are going ahead with an application for permission to have this heard in the Supreme Court.
But the judges were so clear, weren't they? They said there's no unlawful discrimination under EU and human rights law, and the changes were a long overdue move towards gender equality.
That's an opinion which we do not share. And as I say, we are pressing ahead, and we will never retreat. Full restitution is in the crosshairs, and that is our primary goal. 50s women have been discriminated against. 9.8 million men were given 5 years free national insurance contributions to enable them to retire at 60 years of age, which is 5 years early for men. While 3.8 million women were denied their state pensions for up to 6 years and then coerced back to the workplace and latterly amid the pandemic. Now, if that is not discrimination, I really don't know what discrimination is. It's just outrageous that women have been treated in this way. But what it's done, Jenny, it's given birth to a women's movement, and we've launched the CDORPT.com CEDAW People's Tribunal, where the tribunal will be looking at discrimination over the last 40 years. Because CEDAW was ratified in this country 40 years ago, and the Women's Bill of Rights has never been transposed into domestic law. So that's another goal of ours, to transpose Theodore into domestic law so that no other women and girls younger than us will ever have to be subjected to such tyranny.
This is the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, which is the UN law. How do you think that might help this particular cause?
Well, the CEDAW People's Tribunal will be looking at all articles of the CEDAW Convention. I think I'm right in saying there's 18. So there'll be independent judges, academic witnesses, all looking at what I just described. And one of those things will be what's happened to Bisti's women. And by the way, we submitted grave and systemic evidence to the CEDAW Committee in Geneva. And there's a 77th session coming up in October to look at our submission. And there's been four inquiries, I believe, in the last 20 years. And were we to be successful, then the UK government will be investigated for the what we say, what Michael Mansfield called a catastrophic impact on 50 women.
Mansfield, who, of course, is your barrister. So how hopeful are you about the Supreme Court?
We are supremely... We will not retreat. Our evidence is irrefutable, and we stand by everything the legal team has done. A magnificent, world-class legal team that came behind. You know, when I first went to see Michael, I couldn't believe that he and his team were as accepted to represent us.
Joanne, we're going to have to end there because I'm afraid the quality of the line has deteriorated somewhat. But thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning, Joanne Welch. And again, we'd like to hear from you. If you were one of the women born in the 50s who missed out on her pension, what impact has it had on you? Now, if you've been looking at advertising on television, in magazines and in newspapers recently, you may have noticed a distinct change in the way ads are aimed at women. Suddenly there's a lot of wine o'clock, the colour pink, a lot of glitter and the slogan female empowerment. Well, how well does the feminisation of booze work? Kate Bailey is one of the authors of Love Yourself Sober. Dr. Athanasia Daskalopoulou is a lecturer in marketing at the University of Liverpool's Management School. And Carol Emsley is Professor of Substance Use and Misuse at the School of Health and Life Sciences at Glasgow Caledonian University. Carol, what has your research shown are the trends between women and alcohol?
Well, the overall statistics very much show that while men still drink more than women, the gender gap is reducing. We have to be aware that alcohol is a leading global risk factor for early death among women aged under 50, and it's also responsible for around 8% of breast cancer cases worldwide. So it's definitely a cause for concern. Closer to home, I would say that our research at Glasgow Caledonian University has showed how alcohol is used to demonstrate our identity to others. So we went out to talk to women in their 30s and 40s and asked them about drinking and what it meant to them. And we know that from this research, women used alcohol really to try and show their identity beyond the responsibilities associated with being a woman in midlife. And they summed this up with stories and laughter around time out and transformation. So the idea that alcohol provides relaxation at the end of the day and time out from responsibilities, but also this transformation where women felt that they were transformed back to carefree youth away from their responsibilities.
And how would you say, Carol, it's being marketed?
Well, we know that the alcohol industry is increasingly designing and promoting products for women. And so we've seen a move away from sexualizing women to sell alcohol to men towards alcohol brands themselves trying to align their products with sophistication, with women's empowerment, and with female friendship to sell alcohol to women. And this is really straight out of the tobacco industry playbook, with slogans such as "You've come a long way, baby," in the 60s, trying to align products, tobacco in that case, with women's liberation.
Athanasia, what examples have you noticed of advertising to women being linked to feminism, sisterhood, wine o'clock?
It's really not surprising that alcohol companies are targeting women at the moment because their socioeconomic power has increased and also their drinking. So we see a feminization of alcohol products, also of drinking spaces with ladies' nights and drinking culture. We see a lot of trends in terms of developing new products such as fruit beers, ready-to-drink beverages, low-calorie drinks, even low-alcohol products. We also see a change in the messages. So we see a focus on slimness, weight, pink packaging, glitter, messages of sisterhood, all-female friendships, motherhood, and also the all-time favorite, sexiness. Messages of empowerment have increased and of a celebration of women, for example, in association with International Women's Day, Valentine's Day, and even Mother's Day.
Kate, what's been your relationship to alcohol? How much has gender played a part in it?
Well, I think I've been on the ground, as it were, and being in sober forums for the last 8 years. And I definitely, well, most of these forums were set up with pretty much all of them for women by women. And so it's very interesting to hear what sort of comes out of there. And one of the big reasons, Mandy and I wrote our book and do the work we do, is that we saw a massive impact on mothers and this linked kind of mummy juice, wine o'clock, and this that women were using alcohol to kind of, it's the acceptable face of sort of self-medication, stress release. We were sold it as this kind of reward at the end of the day. And once you start unpicking the kind of mental health links, obviously it's the cancer links, and we feel that mums are a very vulnerable group in terms of their mental health. It's something like 1 in 3 experience mental health issues in early motherhood. So it's really like, so when you're sort of self-medicating this kind of anxiety and using it for that kind of reason, you're very vulnerable at risk of sliding down the scale of the alcohol use disorder. So it's not like this, okay, you're normal and then you're an alcoholic. There's a spectrum according to the World Health Organization. So you'll be in that kind of harmful and hazardous place if you are drinking in that way. And we've seen that very much, and myself included. So really there's this kind of like, okay, well, it's the pressures on women.
Kate, what do you make then of the way it seems increasingly to be marketed?
Well, I think there's a few things happening there. I think that there's also been the rise of social media, and I think the kind of mummy wine o'clock, it came out of a kind of a good place. It had a good heart. It was women suddenly, instead of everything looking like a Bowden bum fight and icing the cupcakes and looking like a supermodel, there were real women on the rise of Instagram and social media, you know, breastfeeding in the bathroom, surrounded by, you know, washing. But unfortunately, that real parenting got kind of tied up. It got coupled with drinking. And so you'd have bottles of wine in prams, mummy juice, you know, calm on the outside, Prosecco on the inside. And then the marketeers kind of cashed in on that, is the way I see it, and kind of really ran with that. So I think we've got to really ask what we actually need. You know, it's not about shaming, blaming, being perfect, but what do you need? Are you ragged at the end of the day? Do you need flexible, you know, work? Do you need affordable childcare? Because women are literally limping towards the end of the day and crashing with a few glasses of wine, which is in turn going to make their mental health deteriorate.
Carol, how worried are you about women's best interests not being considered by the manufacturers who are paying for the advertising?
Yeah, I am concerned about this. I think Kate's absolutely right. We shouldn't be blaming women for this. We shouldn't be applying double standards to women in the way that they're more being judged more harshly for their drinking, particularly mothers. But what we need to remember is that alcohol advertising normalises drinking. And although the alcohol industry claims only to market to adult, of course, our young people, our daughters, are consuming the same media and taking in the same alcohol messages as adults. And so I think there's a couple of things we can do. At a policy level, we've got reports coming out, such as the alcohol harm report out yesterday called It's Everywhere, Alcohol's Public Face and Private Harm, which is really calling on the UK government to restrict alcohol advertising. And as Kate said, this needs to be online media as well as broadcast media. We see the rise of social media and influencers selling products to women. We need to think about the alcohol sponsorship of professional sport. And in Scotland, the elite girls team is now being sponsored not by alcohol, but by a public health organisation, SHAP. And we need an independent regulator. So at policy level, we need to restrict alcohol advertising. We need organisations like Kate's to talk about alcohol-free days or alcohol-free lifestyles so it's not normalised. And we can also try and call out some of these images of pink, fluffy, sparkly advertising. So our social media campaign, hashtag DontPinkMyDrink, tries to do this on Twitter, where we ask women to post examples that they've seen in the supermarket of products that are really equating women's drinking with pink, with fun, with friendship, with empowerment.
Athanasia, does this form of advertising work? Are women buying more drink because it's pink and glittery? Or do they think, oh, come on?
Actually, unfortunately, there is a market for this type of empowerment and feminism. But it is important to acknowledge that this is a form of feminism that is mostly white, middle class, cisgendered and heterosexual. And we see that these companies are using empowerment as a form of market segmentation. You know, if only women had the right products, the right alcohol drinks, they could achieve anything. Anything could be possible for them. But we have to acknowledge that feeling empowered is not the same thing as actually being empowered as a woman. And this is really dangerous because these type of advertisements, they promote a type of neoliberal corporate feminism that doesn't actually challenge deep structural inequalities and doesn't contribute to women's movements and struggles. It is a type of feminism that is very accommodating. It is not difficult. It's not threatening. It's not angry. It isn't humorless. You know, you are empowered as a woman who drinks, but you're not a killjoy as well, in the words of Sarah Ahmed.
Kate, briefly, how do you avoid the killjoy term?
Well, one of the reasons I started Love Sober is that I think not only do we need to really call out the cultural, historical and advertising messages around alcohol, but sobriety itself actually really needs a rebrand. And what you are finding on sober forums, you know, behind those closed doors, if you like, it's people having a whale of a time. We're having a much better time once we ask better questions about what we need. There are, you know, club soda campaigns for lovely non-alcoholic drinks in pubs. So you're not punished with an orange juice anymore. You get to grips with what you need. I love what Anastasia said about the, you know, the real empowerment, because we think that actually by putting down the drink and calling time on those messages is a very empowering and kind of joyful thing.
I was talking to Kate Bailey, Dr. Athanasia Daskalopoulou and Carol Emsley. On Twitter came a message on the Jacqueline Wilson conversation from Neve, and she said, I remind you, on Twitter, the secret of happiness in life is not to be on Twitter too much. Wise words from my queen, Jacqueline Wilson. On women and the marketing of alcohol, Kelly McCarthy said in an email, I detest Wine O'Clock and other various sound bites, especially when they feature on plucks in the home. It's normalising alcohol consumption and conflating female autonomy and independence with overindulgence. Mary said on Twitter, all females are seen as consumers. It's how consumerism took off. Of course, the men were the puppet masters in all of this, and the critics too. She spends too much of my money on nonsense. Jenny tweeted to say, Prosecco O'Clock vintage kitchen signs, mugs that say, wish it was wine, gin lip balms, etc., all aimed at women and make alcohol the everyday norm. We can crack on with life without decorating our houses with tat, urging us to have a swig of fizz or gin every half hour. And Fiona emailed to say, I used to work in a women's wear department store. At the end of each busy day, we were encouraged by the managers to go home and have a big glass of wine. It always seemed very unhealthy to me and normalised, even glorified, drinking. Well, thank you for all your responses to today's programme. Do join me tomorrow when we'll be asking whether you're happy to be naked in front of your children or does it make you feel uncomfortable. I'll be talking to the illustrator Rosie Hain, who's created a children's book called It Isn't Rude to Be Nude. Join me tomorrow, 10:02. Bye-bye.
Have you ever wondered what teachers talk about when no one else is listening? Well, you're about to find out. I'm Maureen Bake, and my brand new podcast, The Secret Life of Teachers, goes behind the headlines to see what's really going on as teachers go back to school after the lockdown. I was a teacher for almost a decade, but I never witnessed a time like this. So I've created my own virtual secret staff room where each week some teacher friends and I will discuss everything from remote learning and mental health to Ofsted inspections and teachers behaving badly. If you'd also like to overhear their uncensored staff room confessions, then subscribe to my podcast, The Secret Life of Teachers, on BBC Sounds.